Now, I understand that manufacturing led to worker exploitation and that cotton is now a protected species, but I have to say I do miss wearing clothes.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Hey, can we go inside? I'm freezing.
Hi, I'm Mary Fall, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn, Michigan.
WHFR.FM 89.3 invites you to our Fall 2016 fundraiser. All-Star Jam 2, Saturday, November 12th at the New Place Lounge, 22723 Michigan Avenue, 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. Please join us as Detroit area musicians take the stage and jam to help support non-commercial independent Henry Ford College Radio. $5 donation to this 21 and over event. All proceeds go to help support nonprofit WHFR 89.3. Hope to see you there.
This is the city where danger lurks. Today, a new creature walks among us, causing fear, mayhem, and injury.
Stay back, children.
Mommy, I'm scared.
Look out for the dreaded digital deadwalkers. They're not looking out for you. With faces pressed against their little handheld devices, they put all good citizens in harm's way.
Hey, pal.
Pardon you.
The digital deadwalkers are multiplying. Until their behavior patterns can be modified, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons warns all innocent people to stay alert. Better yet, to step up and speak out.
Hey, dude. I'm walking here.
Sorry, I didn't see you.
A public service message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, who want to keep everyone well-connected with healthy bones.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is retired U.S. Air Force Captain Robert Salas. We've had Mr. Salas on the show before discussing his book, Faded Giant, in which UFOs hovered over Maelstrom Air Force Base in 1967, while our nuclear missiles were rendered inoperable. And today we would like to discuss his latest book, Unidentified, the UFO Phenomenon, how the world governments have conspired to conceal humanity's biggest secret. And reading from the teaser from the book on Amazon, it reads, quote, "In 1969, the U.S. Air Force issued a statement that read, 'No UFO reported, investigated, and evaluated by the Air Force was ever an indication of threat to our national security.' This statement is patently false. It has been proven untrue by the testimony of many military officers and airmen, and documentation of incidents involving UFOs and nuclear weapons, testimonies of which the U.S. Air Force was fully aware. The book details many of these testimonies, some for the first time." So, welcome back to the show, Captain Salas.
Thank you, David. Great to be back with you.
It's good.
And looking forward to our talk.
It's good to have you back here. You have a new book out now. And for our listeners, though, who are unfamiliar with the case, give us a brief overview of the 67 Malmstrom Air Force Base incident.
Okay. I'll try to do that as quickly as I can. I've been through this so many times.
I know it, but it never grows old. Maybe to you, though. All right.
March of 1967, actually March 24th of that year, I was a missile launch officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana. I was part of a two-man crew that would go out to our launch control facilities, what we called them. This one happened to be at Oscar Flight, about 100 miles east of Great Falls, Montana. It's an underground facility, 60 feet underground. We had about six topside guards. We'd go down in an elevator, and then we'd have a change of crews about every 24 hours. Mm-hmm. On this particular evening, and I say evening, it was dark outside. I don't know exactly what time it was. I'm going to approximate now after I thought about it a little bit more. About 7 to 8 p.m. at night.
Mm-hmm.
I get a call from my topside guard, and my commander is taking a nap break. We had to take turns taking a nap down there because one of us had to be awake and alert for the entire period. But I get a call from my topside guard. He's saying there's sea strange lights in the sky and moving at high speeds, stopping on a dime, reversing course, not making any sounds. And they said they weren't aircraft. And they didn't know what they were, but they were flying over the site and wanted to report it. I even said, "You mean like UFOs?" Because we had reports in the local newspaper about strange light sightings. And he said, "Well, you know, we can't explain it." I basically discounted it, hung up, and went back to my reading. He calls back about a few minutes later. This time he's screaming into the phone. He's very upset, frightened, clearly agitated, frightened. He says, "I've got all the guards out here with their weapons drawn. We're looking at a glowing red object, pulsating red light, oval shaped, that is hovering just above our front gate to the facility." He wanted me to tell him what to do next. Well, I was kind of shocked at this report. But obviously he was serious. It wasn't intended to be a joke or anything. I told him, "Just make sure nothing comes in the front gate." So to do whatever you can to keep anything from coming in the front gate. Hung up the phone. I went to tell my commander about this report, and all of a sudden we were getting bells and whistles going off in the capsule. We have a status board that shows the status of our missiles, and we look over there, and each one of them is going from alert status, or green, to red status, no-go status, one by one. So that night we lost 10 nuclear missiles while this object was hovering over the site. My commander calls the command post, and after that call, he turns to me and says, "The same thing happened at another flight." And so I assumed he met that night, but it wasn't until much later that it turns out this was the Echo flight incident, which happened about a week earlier. Now, that was on March 16th, 1967. Mm-hmm. That was a very similar incident where, all 10 missiles were lost while UFOs were seen by security guards, maintenance people at the sites. Those sites were actually being worked on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So within the span of a week, 8 days, we lost 20 nuclear missiles at the same time, UFOs were sighted overhead. By lost, I mean they were temporarily lost. There was no real damage done to the missile systems. It was simply an upsetting of the navigational system, which required the missiles to shut themselves down, since if the navigation system didn't work, they couldn't be properly launched on target. Mm. So that's basically the story in a nutshell.
When they investigated this, I assume Air Force investigated it, right? And did they try an experiment, try to shut these things down, and or try to see what could have shut these things down?
Actually, we do have documents that mention the types of tests they ran to try to figure out what was the cause of the shutdowns. Mm-hmm. And they did try things like that. They looked at things like the possibility of earthquakes in the area that would upset the system. There were no earthquakes reported. They also tried different power source shutdowns. They went ahead and actually shut down power. Now, these missiles, I should mention, had backup power. They had not only the Montana power feed, but they also had generators that would go online if Montana lost power. And they also had batteries that would pick up if the generators didn't work. So they had triple redundancy in power.
Right.
It wasn't a power failure. Power stayed on the entire time. This was an injection of a particular signal into the guidance and control system that affected a particular piece of equipment called the logic coupler. And so they did identify that piece of equipment where the where some signal was sent to it, and a particular signal. I think Boeing even identified a frequency for the signal, an input frequency and power level.
Was that for every?
They also stated, by the way, that this was nearly impossible occurrence, because what would have to happen is the signal would have had to be sent to each logic coupler in each missile.
Right, that's what I was going to ask.
Go ahead.
That's what I was going to ask, if this signal just covered all of these ten units, or if each missile, you know, you had to treat them separately. So you just answered the question.
Yeah. We had cabling systems that went to each missile separately.
Wow.
So this signal, whatever it was, would have to go to each missile separately through each of those cabling systems, which, by the way, were, again, triply shielded against electromagnetic interference.
Wow. So, Maelstrom and the other one, which one did you mention this incident happened as well?
I was at Oscar Flight, which was near Lewistown, Montana, still
right.
is.
Right.
And Echo Flight was about 40 or so miles to the northwest of that.
Okay, so were these two bases the only bases that this type of thing ever happened to?
Oh, no. And these weren't bases, by the way. Both Oscar and Echo are flights of missiles,
okay.
10 each.
Okay.
And both of them are assigned to the 340, no, I'm sorry, the Oscar, oh, the 341st Strategic Missile Wing out of Malmstrom. So they were part of the same base organization. But to answer your question, no, this has happened at other missile bases.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. Walker Air Force Base, 1963, UFOs over Atlas Missile Launch Facilities. Minot Air Force Base, 1967, Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota. UFOs seen over launch control centers disrupted the electronics. And we do have a witness now, Shindelli, Lieutenant Shindelli, that stated that he, when he relieved his crew in 66, that all 10 missiles had been shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Again, UFOs oversight. Minot Air Force Base again in 1968, UFOs over a launch facility. And in that case, when they went out there, the cover to the missile, one of the missile launch facilities,
mm-hmm.
had been removed. Now, this cover weighs about, I believe, 2,000 tons. it's huge. It's and again, 1976, Francis E. Warren, Wyoming. Again, we've got another witness. Well, what I'm telling you is incidents where there are witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Witnesses that have come forward publicly.
Right.
So, Francis E. Warren, Minuteman III Missile Base, UFOs seen over missile sites and launch control centers.
Yeah.
Bruce Fenstermacher, 76, Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri, 76, Ellsworth Air Force Base, South Dakota, 79, Aviano, Italy, over weapons storage area. Bentwaters Air Force Base in the UK in 1980 was also the site of
Rendlesham Forest
nuclear weapons facility.
All right.
2010, Francis E. Warren Air Force Base, again, a large UFO, shut down 50 Minuteman III missiles. We have witnesses, both Air Force and civilians.
And when you say witnesses, not only were they shut down, but they were shut down in the presence of some unknown craft in the vicinity?
That's correct.
Yeah. So if you have all these plus whatever others you have on your list, that where their witnesses have come forward, it kind of begs the question, how many incidents were there worldwide where they didn't come forward? They just kept it secret, you know?
Exactly. Well, of course, we know that the Air Force did not want this information to be public.
Mm-hmm.
And in my book, my latest book, I talk about the cover-up. It was instigated, actually, by our incidents, because the Edward Condon investigation on UFOs, which the Air Force contracted with the University of Colorado in 1966, was ongoing at the time. And, of course, the Air Force did not want the Condon Committee to start snooping into these things. So I go into my book, the way they kept this information from the Condon Committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd like to get into that book in a minute, but I need to take a minute just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with author and UFO researcher, retired Captain Robert Salas. And we're speaking about UFOs over our missile bases. And I've discussed this on our show many times before, that E.T. seems to take a great interest in our nuclear capabilities. Is that true?
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Going back to 1945, even before the first atomic bomb test, UFOs were chased, actually, away from Hanford, Washington nuclear processing plant. before they had a bond test, so we've got records of that.
It's like they can sniff them out, huh?
Yeah.
they
might say so.
They seem to be aware. And have you noticed that UFO sightings have seemed to pick up recently in and around Korea since the North Korea has resumed nuclear bomb testing?
Well, I don't have any direct information of that. There's probably stories like that floating around, but I would not be surprised. They were UFOs were reported in Robert Hastings' book UFOs and Nukes.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about people that were at the nuclear test sites in the Pacific, early in the 50s, especially just before we exploded our first hydrogen bomb.
Mm-hmm.
There were UFO sightings seen by the crew members of the ships that were out there.
Nautilus?
So they are interested in our testing. I'm sure they're interested in the testing being done by the North Koreans and any other areas of the world where tests were being performed.
When I was, I went online and Googled the sightings around Korea, North Korea, South Korea, but South Korea, of course, is not that far from North Korea. And there have been a lot of UFO sightings of late. Now, whether that is new to the area, probably not. But recently, since they've started their nuclear testing again, a lot of sightings. Of course, you're not going to hear about it from the North Korean government.
Probably not.
No. So in your book, your new book, Unidentified, the UFO Phenomenon, tell us a couple cases about that. Tell us about that book.
A couple of new cases?
Yeah, a couple cases
Well, I can tell you that I have very interesting, talk about a very interesting case. Well, they're all interesting, but one was in Iraq in 2006, when I was in Kansas, speaking in Kansas, I met Mark Koch, Koch, K-O-C-H.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a platoon squadron, a platoon sergeant, who, with his platoon, was in August 13th, 2006, was near, he mentioned Radawian Palace, located out just south of Baghdad Airport. And there's a little town there called Makassib.
Mm-hmm.
And while they were on patrol in this town, one of the men noticed overhead there was, couldn't see the stars anymore. So they all stopped, looked up, and sure enough, it was this very large, triangular-shaped object hovering over their location.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire platoon of soldiers saw it. A couple of them I've spoken to, besides Sergeant Koch, confirmed this to me, so I included it in my book. We're still trying to get more details and support on this, but I'm pretty sure it's a valid case. Okay, so that was a very interesting case in Iraq. Did you have any questions about that at this point?
You say, when was this, 2000 what, 6?
2006, yeah.
2006, so all the hostilities were going on over there, and and how many witnesses did that have?
Well, I'd say about over 20.
Mm-hmm.
25, I think, is what he said.
Yeah. So there are a lot of cases, or some cases, in your new book that have not been covered in other books. Am I correct?
Yeah. There's another one at Whiteman Air Force Base in 1976. This was a woman who was married to a security guard.
Mm-hmm.
Who was at the missile sites. UFO came over, and there were also cattle mutilations. Some of these incidents over areas where there are cattle talk about cattle mutilations also.
Can you go into more detail on that one?
Well, in the one I just mentioned, she had worked as a nurse off base, and she was coming back onto the base at Whiteman. She looked over one of the facilities nearby. They happened to have a launch facility right near the main gate. Again, these are Minuteman missiles, and there were a lot of people around this particular area, around this launch center. She said she saw a UFO overhead, a lot of activities, but she actually saw the UFO. When she got home, her husband reported to her later that, yes, it was indeed a UFO report, and that there were also reports of cattle mutilations in the area.
Now, the husband worked for the Air Force, or?
Yeah, her husband was a security guard.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah.
Wasn't he warned not to tell anybody about this?
Well, yes. It's kind of strange. Actually, I just talked to my other main witness, Robert Jameson, who was... One of the people that brought my missiles back up on alert, and before they went out to retarget the missiles, they were warned not to talk about the reports of UFOs. But they didn't have to sign anything. When he went home, he told his wife about it, and the same thing happened here. The sergeant told his wife about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was married at the time, but I had to sign a non-disclosure statement in writing that I would never speak about my incident.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't tell my wife about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't talk to anybody about it until around 1994. And we could go into that a little bit if you want. But I was silent about this whole thing until 1994.
Then what happened?
All right, 1994, I was in a bookstore in Great Falls, in Seattle, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And happened to pick up a book called Above Top Secret by Timothy Good.
Ah.
Happened to turn to page 300 of that book. I was just, browsing through books, and on that page it said, one short paragraph said, UFOs caused the shutdown of missiles in Montana in 1967. So I got kind of excited because I thought the Air Force might have declassified that. Because I was still sworn to secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I checked into it, I was cautious, but I asked an investigator for a MUFON to look into this and possibly submit a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request. He did. That was Jim Klotz, who's my co-author on Fate of Giant. When we got the first response back from the Air Force, they said, this is classified information. By the way, we didn't ask for anything about UFOs. We just wanted to know more about this strange shutdown of a a flight of missiles during a UFO. Well, strange shutdown of flight of missiles. We didn't even mention anything about UFOs.
Right.
The Air Force wrote back and said, you know, this is classified, but since it's been so long, we're going to declassify it and we'll send you what documents we had. And so they did. They started sending us documents on the Echo Flight incident, the one I mentioned that happened in March 16th.
Not yours, though. Not your incident.
It wasn't mine, but I thought it was mine.
Okay.
You know, because at the time,
it was just Montana.
Time had gone by, I forgot where I had been because the we would move around from time to time, different sites. They all looked the same.
Mm, well, sure.
And so I really forgot where exactly I was at the time of my incident.
Mm-hmm.
But this described my incident so accurately. Missiles being shut down while UFOs were overhead. That I thought it was my incident. So I started talking about it. I went public and said, this, we have documents the Air Force confirms that Echo Flight went down and I was there, et cetera. I actually went on TV. I think I went on the sightings program claiming that I was the one there in the site when the missiles went down.
All right.
Well, it wasn't for a couple of years later when I finally contacted my actual commander. I didn't even remember who my commander was. You got to remember, this was 94, this happened 67, so about 27 years had gone by.
Mm-hmm.
So my memory was a little cloudy about the specifics, but
well,
I finally got a hold of my commander, Fred Meiwald. And he said, you know, we weren't at Echo Flight. We were at Oscar Flight.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, I couldn't renege it as to what I had been so public about. So I just kept talking. And I've been speaking out about this for over 20 years now.
Okay, so these documents that they released to you, did they that they declassified and released to you, did they mention UFOs or just the
there was
shutdown?
One mention of UFO in one of the documents we received was a unit history report. And in that document, there's a paragraph that says, I haven't got it in front of me, but to the effect that the report of UFOs during the Echo Flight shutdown was discredited. Or the rumors, I'm sorry, the rumors of UFOs was discredited or something like that.
Okay,
well,
didn't say how it was discredited or who
discredited. No, it didn't say how it was discredited. And I actually wrote to the author of this unit history report, and he responded to my letter.
Mm-hmm.
And said that, you know, he never interviewed any of the airmen involved.
Mm-hmm.
So he said this is another example of editorials done above and beyond the facts, something like that, in the letter he wrote back.
Yeah, I like it when, you know, there'd be an incident, whatever it might be, and there's just tons of evidence and tons of witnesses and even physical evidence to show that something something out of the ordinary occurred. And so, of course, we go to ET intervention, whatever, and some skeptic will come out with, that was proven to be a hoax. You ever hear that exact phrase? That
oh,
was
absolutely.
Proven to be a hoax.
Proven to be a hoax.
And I say to them, really, who proved it and what was their proof?
Yeah, right.
And, well, I don't know. I just, you know, I heard. This is what I heard. You ever heard that phrase before?
Yeah,
I've heard.
And in fact, in 1968, I mentioned the one that Minot Air Force Base there was a major Runyon, Bradford Runyon,
mm-hmm.
Who was a co-pilot on the B-52.
Mm-hmm.
They were coming in to land, and the general of the base gets on the radio, tells them to go around and look at this, see if they can see something at this particular spot. And sure enough, there was a UFO on the ground there.
On the ground?
Yeah. And anyway, the whole crew saw the thing. And there was a sketch drawn of it. And then when he landed, he was given a debrief by this general and told that, UFO had been seen over the site. In fact, that was the one where the lid or the cover for the missile had been removed. And again, this was about 2,000 tons, if I'm not mistaken.
How could that? How is that possible?
How
was that removed normally?
Well, normally it's on tracks. It's on like railroad tracks.
All right.
And the way it's displaced from its position is through a very large mechanical system that. It rolls back on its tracks, and it opens up the missile tube so the missile can be launched.
Okay.
But there's no way you can lift it because it's attached to these tracks. But this thing was taken off that location and placed on the ground next to it. Pretty amazing stuff. And, it was investigated by... Blue Book. Matter of fact, Colonel, I don't remember his name, Quintanilla. Colonel Quintanilla, who was head of Blue Book at the time, came out and interviewed witnesses, etc. And his final conclusion was, no, you guys were looking at the star, I think it was Vega or something like that. You were looking at some star. That's so he dismissed the entire thing. And this is a crew of B-52 pilots and crew.
Well, of course, they wouldn't know what a star looks like.
It's taking the light on the ground, or the object on the ground, for a star.
But
how believable is that?
Did Blue Book ever give an explanation for the removal of that cover?
No, they didn't talk about that.
They didn't talk about that.
It was classified information.
Classified information, huh?
Right.
Hmm.
In fact, you know, the Blue Book files are available. I think they're at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and anybody can go look at the Blue Book files.
Yeah.
But those aren't all the files.
No.
In other words, we discovered... or I did, when I was investigating this second book that I wrote, that Blue Book actually had classified files that they did not reveal to the Condon Committee until after the Condon Report was finished. So they had classified files on UFO incidents, and these were the more reliable incidents. That's why they were classified.
But you say Condon Committee did not have those files.
No, they didn't have access to them, even though the order that was issued when the Condon Committee was set up stated that they would have access to all files.
But they didn't.
So, they weren't given them. No.
So that's like saying, I need you to explain a certain phenomenon, but I'm not going to tell you anything about the phenomenon. Give me an explanation, please.
I'm not going to tell you everything I know about the phenomenon. Exactly.
And it does you no good whatsoever to argue with these guys, because they will give you some moronic explanation that doesn't fit the evidence, and or just, you know, leave... bits and pieces of evidence out. What about that? Well, you know, It's one of those things. Now, let's move on. Nothing to see here.
That's right. Yeah. Move along.
Move along. Oh, my goodness. I need to take one more break to remind our listeners, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and that's 89.3 FM on your radio dial. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with a researcher and author, retired Captain Robert Salas. And, okay, so any other interesting cases from your book,
Oh, yes.
Unidentified?
I also mentioned a case, Ellsworth Air Force Base, which is in South Dakota, 1976. In this case, very similar to mine, UFOs came over the launch control facility, and they interrupt operations over that facility. And again, this object hovered over the launch control center, and that's where the capsule was located.
Mm-hmm.
It controls the missiles. However, this time, the crew upstairs, without coordinating with the commander downstairs, underground, fired M16 rounds at the object.
Huh.
In fact, they fired, I believe it was about 183 rounds at this thing.
Wow.
All to no effect, of course.
Right.
What's unusual about this is that the officer in charge, who I've been talking to, the commander at the capsule, was interrogated after this by the AFOSI, Air Force Office Special Investigation, and the Office of Naval Intelligence extensively, because for one reason, he had lost 10 minutes, so he had about 10 minutes of missing time during this incident where he couldn't remember, there's no memory of what happened.
Right.
He was taken to the hospital and for no good reason, but he was hospitalized. He said he didn't have any physical problems, but during that hospitalization, he was interrogated at length, injected with drugs, and again interrogated. Now, why did they do this? My suspicion is that they wanted to know whether or not he had been literally abducted from the facility during this incident.
Could have been.
Also, any more details that he couldn't remember during that 10 minutes
right,
of missing time,
right,
supposedly.
Right.
So,
kind of like a hypnotic drug to get to the truth that's in the subconscious, right?
Right. Well, yes. The CIA, of course, we know, especially in that time period, 70s, mid-70s, was working on kind of truth drugs and drugs that might impact people's memories.
Right.
We see this again, talk about this again in the Bentwaters case, 1980, so just
right.
4 years later.
Larry Warren. Larry Warren.
What's that?
Larry Warren stated
right.
that he was, felt he had been drugged.
Exactly. Yeah. Not only Larry, but a lot of the other people involved, airmen, were drugged, and... I'm convinced that they were given false memories, or their memories were, let's say, messed with. And,
right.
But again, this is the type of thing that I'm convinced is being done to witnesses to try to discredit their stories.
Right.
And it's being done deliberately by what I call the UFO cabal.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Chapter 4 of your book. Chapter 4 of your book.
What's that?
I was going to ask you about that. In Chapter 4 of your book, it's called the UFO Cabal. What exactly is that?
Well, we have information and a record of people's claiming that there is indeed a secret group that has been controlling this information, keeping it from the public.
Mm-hmm.
You go back to 1950, for example, with Canadian Wilbert Smith.
Right.
I don't know if you've heard that story.
I remember.
Wilbert Smith was an engineer who was assigned to work with U.S. secret investigation on something called gravimetrics, and it turns out that at that time they were thinking about UFOs somehow using gravity waves to control their craft, and he was involved with that. He was told that there is a secret group headed by Vannevar Bush who is investigating the entire UFO question. That's kind of the entry, but it makes sense that, and of course we heard about Majestic 12 later on.
Right. So,
from documents that we supposedly retrieved establishing by President Truman a group of 12 individuals, high-level government officials that were studying the UFO question.
Mm-hmm.
So I go into that a little bit, but I'm convinced that there has to be, because these sightings are worldwide. There has to be people, probably in intelligence communities worldwide. They're coordinating efforts to keep this material classified, at least the more interesting and validated material, and possibly artifacts, hard, you know, objects that they've retrieved,
right,
and very possibly the ETs themselves.
All right. So two questions come to mind here. How are world governments able to conspire to conceal the UFO phenomenon, and why do they want to do so when, if indeed a fact, it would be the greatest truth in the history of mankind?
Yeah, I think bottom line, if you want my bottom line, I think it's power and influence. I think initially it was a fear of possible panic by the public, the effect on our social systems, such as religions, the stock market, you name it, you know, that they did not know how the public would react to the verification that this is a true phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's no longer a valid reason.
No.
I think because of all the, let's say, attention that has been brought to this through film and through books and testimonies, et cetera, et cetera, I think the public is now ready or more interested in knowing the facts, and I don't think there would be a panic-type reaction to it. But the reason the cabal wants to keep it secret is because they have the real goods. They have the facts, and they have probably used information derived from recovered objects, etc., to let's say given and promoted through industry as their own inventions, technologies that they've used and utilized on military or you know, classified projects.
Right.
And they would have a lot of explaining to do, let's put it that way. It'd be a political bombshell among all these countries that have had access to this information. And I think they have shared the information. In fact, when I was in South America a couple of years ago, I spoke to an officer, a military officer. I won't go into these details right now, but who said that there was, in fact, he attended a meeting where there were military people at high level, general officers, from the U.S. and from his country, where they discussed exchanging information on UFOs. And there's a particular interesting case from Brazil called the Varginha case. Varginha is an area near Sao Paulo. And I'm trying to think of the year. It escapes me right now, but the case is pretty well documented now, where, again, a UFO crashes in the jungles near this area of Varginha. One of the occupants, at least, escapes the crash alive and was seen in the countryside by various witnesses.
This is in Brazil?
What's that?
This is the case in Brazil?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that, yeah. Roger Lear wrote a book on that.
Roger Lear wrote a book on it, yes. Yes. But there is more and more. There's a recent book written by, and it escapes me, but there's a more recent book on it written by a Brazilian.
Oh.
Where he has interviewed the witnesses again. But in that case, U.S. Embassy personnel were seen near, well, at the hospital where this particular extraterrestrial being who was captured and later died at this hospital was being autopsied. So I'm convinced from that and many other cases that there is a group of people probably attached to intelligence communities within those countries that is sharing information on UFO phenomenon and keeping it classified away from the public.
Would not be surprised at all. And America would be asking for whatever they have. And that tell them, you know, you'll give it to me on no uncertain terms.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, that's
yeah, US. Because that kind of information can be used as political poker chips, right?
Certainly.
To exchange favors, let's say.
Right. So there's a chapter in your book called E.T. and Me. So. Right. What about E.T. and you?
Okay, well, in this book, I go public on my own encounter with E.T.
Okay.
Previously, I had spoken about it, I think, a couple of years ago. I went public. This has to do with the abduction phenomenon, which is very much a real part of this phenomenon, which has not been discussed enough.
Do you have conscious memory?
Briefly, in 1985, and I can validate that this phenomenon exists because of my own incident.
Okay.
1985, I was living in Manhattan Beach with my wife and two small children in a house. Sometime in the middle of the night, I wake up and notice that there's a bluish light coming from our living room. We didn't have any lights on in the living room at night. So I wake my wife up and I asked her if she sees the light. She said yes. And so I'm concerned that somebody's in the house. I'm going to get up and investigate. I try to get up and all of a sudden I'm paralyzed. I can't move. And so the first point I'd like to make is why I don't think that I'm convinced this was not a dream is because I remember physical condition I was in. I was struggling very hard to regain my mobility. even yelled back to my wife and turned, and she was unconscious at this point. Now, again, we had two small kids in the house, and I'm sure she would not have gone back to sleep under these conditions. But I couldn't move. The next thing I recall was seeing a figure in the doorway. I couldn't make out the face, but it had a hood on. And I recall there were others in the room that seemed to me like children. I don't really have a specific memory of what they looked like. It's just that they were small.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I recall is being lifted off the bed and approaching a window, going through the window. And at that point, the next thing I recall is being on a table where they showed me a needle. I was shown a very large, long needle and told that they were going to insert this into my groin area and it would not hurt. Well, when they did do that, inserted the needle, it hurt like hell.
It was, I was going to say,
very, very painful.
Didn't hurt them a bit, did it?
And I remember that pain. That was the second reason this was not a dream, because I have never felt pain like that in my life. When I complained about the pain immediately went away.
Hmm.
It's gone, just like that. But I remember the pain. That was basically it. There were a few other details which I don't have time to go into.
Did your wife recall the onset of this, seeing the blue light?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, my wife. You know, I didn't even talk to my wife about this the next day. This was 1985. Neither one of us mentioned it until 2007. So we're talking, 22 years later.
Huh.
I was giving a talk in Ireland. And one of those speakers had been an abductee. And I turned to my wife and I said, "Do you recall some night back in the 80s where we both saw a blue light in the bedroom?" And she said, "Yes, yes." So she confirmed it, that she too saw that light on that evening. So that convinced me to go forward and speak with hypnotherapists and get more details. And that's how I was able to come up with more details on
it. Well, everything that you've mentioned, the light and being paralyzed, being floated through the window or the wall, whatever, all of that fits with so many other abductees' reports.
Yes.
So, yeah. Was that the only incident you recall?
It's the only incident that I recall. However, I did keep a journal of little bits and pieces of memories that have come forward. At some point, I might delve into that a little bit more.
I haven't
gone into yet more hypnotherapy since this book was it.
All right. Okay, so the name of your book, once again, give us that. Your latest book.
It's called Unidentified UFO Phenomenon, and you can get it on Amazon. You can get Amazon books.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
How world governments have conspired to conceal humanity's biggest secret. Now, is that part of the subtitle?
Yes, that's part of the subtitle. Okay.
Yes. What, you just didn't recall that? Or you
well, it's just
didn't feel you had
an explanation of the title, I guess.
I always say jokingly, was that the title or the first chapter, you know? Captain Robert.
And also, if people want more information on the support I have for my story, the evidence, you can go to my website, spiralgalaxy.org. And if they go to the area where I talk about my incident, you'll see documents and statements from some of the other witnesses, even audio recordings of a couple of the other witnesses.
Okay. So there is evidence to support it. So
Absolutely.
Yeah. Captain Robert Salas, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And
thank you, David.
And one day we'll do this again, okay?
Okay, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. Tuesday Forum, yeah. And then the date that you want to listen to. And We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. It's ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Yo, guys and dolls out there, you're at the malt shop with Daddy G. We're going back to the 50s and the 60s. And so hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror and grab your favorite squeeze and head on down to the malt shop and join me where the jukebox is playing and the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
Yes, I say, come on over, baby. Baby, you can't go wrong. We ain't faking it. Oh, a lot of shaking going on. Well, I say, come on over, baby. We got chicken in the corner. Woo, huh? Come on over, baby. Baby, I got the bull by the horn. We ain't faking.